Hey, how are you? This is the Football Diary Podcast. My name's Mike. I'm with Miles. Hello, mate.
How you doing, mate? You okay?
Decent, thank you. Some monster clashes in the Premier League this week, of course. The battle for top four between Villa and Spurs. The push for Europe with Wolves finding some momentum despite their injury setbacks. And of course, the title race, which is where we will start. It's become a title race, hasn't it, Miles, with the result between City and Liverpool, 1-1. An entertaining game by all accounts, I think, and one that I hope neither would win as a Manchester United fan. I'm sure Arsenal fans were feeling just as happy with that result as well and how it panned out. How did you find this final possible Premier League clash between Pep and Klopp, mate? Was it as big and as entertaining as everyone in the media seemed to make it out to be for you?
Maybe I'm alone at this. I found it a bit underwhelming. No, to be fair, you have to give everything the caveat of this isn't Liverpool's strongest team, obviously, and they're at Anfield, so you'd put them as the favourite team for it, even against Man City, normally. But on an occasion like this, when they're missing so many players, it was a great performance from them to kind of get it over the line, and perhaps they could have got more from it at times. I think we always anticipate that this game is the blockbuster one of the season, and in some ways it kind of lived up to that billing, but I do think maybe it's inflated slightly based on the history of this fixture. It was a good draw.
I think, yeah, the history of the fixture, the history between the managers, and obviously if one of these teams won this game, it felt like they would probably be in control and on points, definitely. Yeah. But I think for momentum as well, it would have meant a lot. So for it to have been a draw just keeps it alive for the neutral, doesn't it, for in many ways. But I just think it's fascinating, the clash of styles, because City just thrive on control, don't they? And they had that for a good, 20-30 minutes in the first half. Whereas Liverpool and Klopp seem to want to encourage a bit of chaos for it to become a game and to become wide open. And City just hate it when that's the case. And the second half was exactly like that, wasn't it? But for a while, I thought City could have capitalised on taking the lead.
Yeah, it was interesting because Liverpool definitely had chances because they kind of played into Man City's weaker areas and, like you say, tried to be chaotic. Like, I'm sure we'll come on to talk about Luis Diaz in a moment, and his performance can really be summed up with that word. And of course, you've got someone like Darwin Nunez, who is the physical embodiment of chaos. Whereas Man City, obviously, I think there was a sign in the second half that they were really losing control when they brought Kovacic on, and they were just desperate to try and get the game to slow down a little bit. But even they seem a bit uncertain of how much they want to do that, because they've got their own kind of chaos theory, and Jeremy Doku comes on and he caused a lot of chaos towards the end. So, yeah, I think that's why I say that I think the quality of this fixture might have been slightly inflated, because I've just used the word chaotic or chaos about 18 times in the last 1 minute and you brought it up as a topic. Do you want quality football to be described in that way? It was entertaining, definitely, but it looked like these two teams were just desperate not to let the other one win. And that kind of manifested itself in it being a draw and them going all out for a win. They didn't really seem to take much care over some of the other more fundamentals of the game at times.
That's a good way of putting it, to be fair. But I think it's one of those games where I think Liverpool definitely tried harder to win and probably could have had more chances to win as well. I think Luis Diaz, as you said, had a couple of chances to score goals, and it's just his end product wasn't there, was it, for both of them? And it's frustrating to watch him sometimes, but he gets himself into such good positions. And I think Jurgen Klopp described this as probably his best performance against City, or at least the kind of most on the ropes he's seen City be. And that is full credit to Liverpool for me and the way they did approach it, especially in the second half, don't you think?
Yeah, they were really confident and really brave with it. I mean, you've got this young lad, Quansah, at the back, who's willing to take on Erling Haaland for half the game and still progress up the pitch with the ball at his feet. So Liverpool didn't shy away from it as a challenge, definitely not. And I think the recent success in the cup final, Guardiola's talked quite a lot himself about how he often uses that as a momentum builder for a title race, and Liverpool have been able to do that. So there was definitely an air of confidence in this Liverpool side, and no one possesses that more than Diaz when he's willing to take on a fullback. It was an interesting battle, wasn't it? Watching him run at Kyle Walker quite often, and it seemed like he was slipping through and beating players without ever really having full control of what he was doing at times. But it's really hard to defend when someone is running directly at you. You're forcing the defender to drop back and try and occupy the space. But at some point, you have to step up and challenge. And that's when Diaz was really good at pouncing. It was just a shame that he didn't have that clinical nature to follow up and finish, because his performance probably did deserve a goal, actually.
That unpredictability is the kind of thing I think you can just tell Pep Guardiola hates to face. And he won't be sad to see the back of Jurgen Klopp because of that reason. His Liverpool teams have always been unpredictable to an extent. And that's just been taken to another level, I think, with Luis Diaz and Darwin Nunez as well. And the way they seem to just create chances at the minute, not yet finishing them. But I think there would be a point with the right coaching that that might come to fruition and they could both thrive on that. And when that happens, and if that happens, Liverpool will be a much more formidable kind of proposition than they are now. But I think they've performed admirably, and it pains me to say that as a United fan. But
no, they really have.
The last few weeks, I feel like they've really sort of shown not just the strength and depth, but you know, the way all the players that are coming to sort of play second fiddle, and they're coming in, like Kelleher, for example, had a great game.
Yeah.
Kwanzaa, like you mentioned, they're all kind of stepping up and fitting into the system. And that's down to Klopp.
And now City have to find that as well, because obviously Edison looks like he'll be out for, I think, up to 4 weeks, I saw earlier. So that's a massive part of their team going. But when you talk about Guardiola not liking anything that's too unpredictable, well, what about how unpredictable was it that Edison would fly out and make such a rash challenge to kind of get Liverpool back into the game as well? That was a bizarre moment from a keeper of his sort of quality, don't you think?
Some of the best and worst of City in both the goals, to be fair, because City's first goal, obviously, the corner routine from Kevin De Bruyne and the whip that almost went out of play when he sent it into the box, right near the post as well for John Stones to put in the box, and the goal, sorry. That was a bit of genius, and you thought it was really well crafted. But then for the penalty, like you say, Ake's back pass was another example of just
shocking
poor decision making and poor quality. So we've seen a lot of the best and the worst of City just in one game there, haven't we?
Yeah, and then you've got a player like Jeremy Doku who showed us the best and worst of his game in the space of like 2 minutes. Like when you are fighting to claim a result, you have that moment where he hits the inside of the post and you think City are about to snatch all 3 points. And then this challenge in the box that he... I think I'll go as far as saying he gets away with. I think it probably was a penalty. I don't know. I've gone back and forth over it because there is contact on the ball, which, great. But it's quite reckless and it does endanger the player. His foot is very high to catch you in the chest. That's very, very high. So you do have to question it. The thing is, more than anything, you just don't need to give the ref a decision to make that late in a game, particularly the game of this magnitude. And actually, I wonder if that might have influenced the ref's decision that it is such an important game and a moment at the title that you don't want to get that wrong. And it's just safer to not give anything and let VAR give you a decision instead.
Yeah, but VAR checked it and was like, nothing doing. I think the explanation at the end of the game from the ref was that, the touch on the ball changes everything. It reminds me a bit of when United played Wolves first game of the season, or very early on in the season, and Onana just took out one of Wolves' players. And like, he got the ball, but my God, he took the player as well, didn't he? Like, is that a penalty? Yeah, it probably should be. I think that amount of contact just changes the way the attack goes. It just completely nullifies everything, doesn't it?
Well, particularly when he put McAllister on the floor and he basically tackled Salah from the floor. Like, the ball drops quite favourably to Salah in the box there, but McAllister's in a heap on the floor in front of him, so it stops Liverpool from progressing. It would have been a sad way to see that game end, I think, and you don't really want it to be decided on moments like that. But if you're a Liverpool fan, you don't care. You feel like you should get the decision. I can see why it wasn't given, because, like I say, there is contact on the ball.
Yeah.
If it was my team, I'd probably be screaming for it, though.
Yeah, 100%. I think this really kind of shows how good Liverpool have been in this game, because there's so many players in Liverpool's team that you put at least as a 7 out of 10, don't you think? Whereas how many of City's played at that level? We'll talk about Kevin De Bruyne quickly as well, because he got taken off for Kovacic around the 60th minute or something like that. And he was visibly fuming, wasn't he? And you could see Guardiola trying to like explain and rationalise his decision tactically why that was the best thing. But he lost possession a few times, De Bruyne, and despite his genius assist, he didn't quite settle into this game ever, did he?
No, and I think it's important that we remember, obviously, that De Bruyne has had a big chunk of this season on the sidelines as well, and is still kind of growing into this City system for this year as well, because actually both him and Haaland were quite quiet in this game. And normally, we've seen that a few times, that Haaland against the bigger sides isn't always as effective as you'd like him to be, because it's harder for him to get those moments. And normally it's De Bruyne that creates those moments, even against a team like Liverpool. So it was odd to see a performance like this from him. I mean, he still gets an assist for an incredible bit of thinking from that set piece. But Yeah, I don't know. I think we've talked a lot recently about how the spotlight in this City team is on some newer players, and actually, like, Phil Foden has really stepped up this season, although he was largely anonymous in this game. And of course, Jeremy Doku came in, and because he's quite a flair player that we're not used to in a Man City team, that takes a lot of attention too. So I can see why De Bruyne was frustrated, because he knows in his ability, no matter what kind of game he's having, if there's 25 minutes of a game left, De Bruyne can still have an impact on it. So I was surprised to see him go off when City were looking to kind of gain that control. But I think it was maybe an indication from Pep that he was worried about losing too many battles, and Kovacic would just be there to kind of sturdy things up a little bit.
Yeah, I think so. It was just about retaining some kind of control where he could, because it was slipping from him at that point, wasn't it? But in terms of control, Arsenal have it in the title race at the minute. And on goal difference, admittedly, but the amount of goals Arsenal have been scoring in the last few weeks has really turned that around for them, hasn't it? And they won 2-1 against Brentford. Brentford get a reputation for being a nice team, a good Premier League team, and they are. But they're really hard to play against, aren't they? They can be a pretty nasty team to play against sometimes. But Arsenal saw this one through quite easily, I thought, in the end. You know, they create a lot of chances. Declan Rice, I thought, had a brilliant game. Kai Havertz scored for his fourth Premier League game in a row. Who'd have saw that coming? And even Aaron Ramsdale's mistake couldn't really dampen the occasion for Arsenal. They must be thrilled with this weekend.
Yeah, I think he got himself a bit of redemption as well. He made some excellent saves. Obviously, there was that header from Nathan Collins that he kept out. And of course, that audacious effort from Ivan Toney that he was backpedaling and kind of readjusted his body really well to tip that over. Yeah. So yeah, it was impressive. But I think it does cement the idea of why he's not Arsenal's first choice, because we know he's a good shot stopper. We know he can do those things when he needs to. But that vulnerability at his feet is not how Arteta wants to play right now. So it's a shame that that mistake happened, actually. But he grew into the game, and I'm proud of him in a weird way to see him kind of not let that affect him too much. But yeah, it's a great win for Arsenal. And we've seen this a few times this season where they've had these moments where they get wins late on. And that's what you need to see a title over the line. It could have very easily been 2 points dropped, and instead it continues their momentum and continues this build since their winter break that makes them look, dare I say, almost like favourites at the moment.
That's my next kind of overarching like question for you, because not many people are going into this thinking Arsenal are overwhelming favourites. And I think that's because the fixtures are still to be played that could decide a fair amount, really. It's not a given that any team's going to win all their games. It feels like this is the season where teams will drop points more than ever, doesn't it? Being a 3-horse race. But for Arsenal, I've mentioned their mental strength before, or fragility, as we've seen in previous seasons. And that, I think, might be the deciding factor here. Have you seen anything in Arsenal's game that's made you doubt that they can continue to get results like this and to continue to grind out and coast at the same time? Because they've had a bit of both since the new year, haven't they?
Yeah, do you know what? No, which is rare, because you are right. Like, there always seems to be a caveat with certain teams that we expect them to drop off. But actually, I think the way that Arsenal are performing right now, and the fact that they're not reliant on one player in excellent form as much as they have players who are performing really well, it's such a well-rounded contribution to the effort that actually it makes me think that that is sustainable. It seems more like a system rather than a run of good fortune. I mean, last season, they hit their form early and then dropped. I wonder if there is something to be said of they've hit form at the right time. Because we see City kind of follow this model all the time, don't we? That post-Christmas, that's when they kind of become that juggernaut. And at the moment, that is Arsenal. They're winning everything. I think the fact that they're still spreading the goals out, someone like Kai Havertz, who came under so much scrutiny when he first came in, is now, what, 4 goals and 2 assists in his last 4 games. That's an excellent return for him right now. And he's growing in confidence at that club and proving that actually, while they are trying to get things over the line, they've got valuable assets. Like, Jesus came back into this game as well, and Trossard's still effective. So yeah, I don't see any reason why Arsenal can't continue this form. The problem is all three of these clubs now really are looking to be flawless to the end of the season.
Got to be.
Because they'll keep each other going like that, and they'll put the necessity on each other to be perfect. And they can't all be perfect. Like, Arsenal obviously have got Man City quite soon as well, and that'll be really huge. It's a really interesting run-in. I'm really excited by it.
I think that's the thing I'm trying to visualise, is City versus Arsenal at the Etihad with so much riding on it in like a Super Sunday game with the cameras. Can you see them buckling under pressure there? Because based on what we've seen from City against Liverpool, if Arsenal kind of follow that chaotic blueprint to an extent and don't overthink it and play the game they've been playing, because going forward, they've been superb. And even Ben White getting two assists in this game.
Yeah.
They've got some players really contributing on a different level now. I can see them taking advantage of, should we call it a wobble, but Man City looking a little bit like they could be got at, you know?
A team of Arsenal's quality definitely could take something from Man City. It's difficult because it's at the Etihad and you always kind of back Man City at home. But right now, Arsenal are the better team out of the two. Mm. So I wouldn't go as far as saying they're favourites when they go visit Man City at the Etihad, because that's, I don't think any club is. Mm. But if they're going to get a result in a title run-in, this is the time, it feels like, absolutely. And we'll see. I think little things like this game, even like getting that late goal to see it over the line, that is a mentality test that they've passed. So they've just got to keep carrying that kind of momentum forward.
Do you know what? Mentality tests is exactly what the right way of describing their season from now on in, isn't it? Because they had this for the title running last time around and they failed them and then failed again. And it felt like they kept tripping up at the wrong times and it just snowballed, didn't it, in terms of negative form. But this time around, it doesn't feel like that's the case. They've been a bit lucky to an extent as well. And I'll talk about Kai Havertz and his goals, obviously, but was he lucky to still be on the pitch, do you think? Potential second yellow for what looked like it was a dive? There's a lot of uproar about that.
Yeah, there is. But let's be honest, the standard of referee in this country at the moment is so abysmal that, okay, yeah, he probably should have been sent off. Arsenal probably should have had about four penalties in the game as well. Like, it's all relative in this fixture, I thought. There was a moment where Trossard got brought down with almost like a choke slam. Like, he just wrapped his arm around his neck. And they didn't get anything for that. So there's only so much complaining you can do. It was very silly from Havertz. When you're on a yellow, to take that dive, it's really poor. The only thing is, obviously, VAR doesn't intervene with stuff like that. So you kind of can get away with it. He's never going to have won a penalty for that. VAR would look at it all day and see that it wasn't a foul. So I'm not really sure what his methodology was there, what he was trying to do. He probably should have been sent off, but okay. Arsenal probably still would have won the game if we got every decision correct in this game.
Yeah, well, let's not get it twisted. Arsenal, I think, were pretty dominant in the game, and I think the stats back that up as well. Although Brentford were difficult to beat at times, I think Arsenal found a solution. And again, it's another one of those mental tests ticked off in some ways, isn't it? So fair play to them. But Brentford looked poor, I think. And they're one of those teams that I always thought were a safe mid-table team, but they're sliding, aren't they? They're not out of the relegation picture yet either. Let's go to Aston Villa, losing 4-0 to Tottenham in the top four clash. Mate, honestly, what happened in this game to make Spurs win so emphatically, first of all? We'll talk about Villa eventually, of course we will. But it was an impressive win for Spurs, wasn't it? And needed as well.
Yeah, because the race seemed like it might get away from them at stages in the season, but they've kind of brought the players back that they needed to. They've got some more consistency in the squad, and now they're able to kick on. They were excellent in this game, actually. They were really efficient. The first half seemed quite a drab affair at times, but actually I think that was even a testament to how well Spurs were playing and how well organised they were. They pressed really high. They didn't allow Villa any space in the defensive areas or midfield areas to play the ball out, and that was huge. And they forced errors, so that was really successful. And actually going forward, they were really clinical. And it was interesting to see that the goals were kind of spread out again across this attacking line that Spurs are developing. Like, Timo Werner came on and got himself one. Obviously, Son got himself on the score sheet, as he always seems to against Villa. And that's what Spurs want to see right now, because they're another team that we talked about. How do they replace Harry Kane's goals? Mm. Well, four away from home at a complete competing rival right now. And what is it, 39 games in a row they've scored now? It's like the second longest run in Premier League history.
Incredible, yeah.
Like, it's incredible. So, yeah, they were excellent. They played really, really well. The way that the midfield was organised to press Villa was superb. And Saar in particular had an excellent game, didn't he? And it was hard to watch.
You've been pretty gracious about the result, to be fair, but 4-0 was an inflated figure, really, wasn't it? With John McGinn sending off, I think that really changed the shape of how the game could have finished. I think Villa was still chasing an equaliser, even a goal to get back in the game at late in the game, you know, and it could have happened, but that red card, and suddenly there's no chance of them getting back into it at all. Are you mad with John McGinn? Do you think that was a worthy red? We've talked about this and whether that's reckless or endangering the player. What's your thoughts on it?
I'm really conflicted on it. At the time, I definitely had no complaints because it was a terrible challenge. Whether I would have thought it was a straight red or not, depends why. It doesn't really endanger the opponent, I don't think, if I'm honest. Like, Ndoggy gets straight back up. He dives back down, but I think that's to make a meal out of the challenge rather than go and confront a player for a poor challenge. It wasn't violent conduct. I don't know. It was just stupid, to be honest. But I actually weirdly empathise with McGinn, because we saw for that sort of 5-minute period just leading up to the red card, he was the only one who had any intensity on the pitch for Villa. Yeah. It was like he was the only one who realised there was a game still to be played and won. And I think the reason he dived into that challenge so much was because he was just doing 11 players worth of running.
Pure frustration.
And I think he just lost it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was partly frustration, and partly he thought, I'm just going to bring some energy back into the game. And you know what? Sometimes players do that. They put in quite a hard tackle to try and gear the crowd up, show their teammates, no, we're fighting right now. And he timed it terribly. So it did kill the game off for us. It absolutely did. And the worrying thing was, I think their heads really dropped in the last sort of 5 minutes and let Spurs get two more. And obviously, you don't want to take a batter into your goal difference when you're trying to improve that. It was just, to me, it was a massive sign of the fatigue from a European fixture, if I'm honest.
Probably.
Because not to make excuses for them, but they just didn't look in it. They just, they looked so lackluster. And I'm not used to saying that about a Villa side. Like, so far this season, we've controlled games, we've passed the ball really well, we've pressed as a unit. And they just didn't seem able to. They just seemed like they were quite happy to let the game happen to them. Like, they had 30% possession. We've not seen that at Villa Park.
True.
So, yeah, it was frustrating. And the change in system really played into Spurs' hands as well. Like, obviously, he went with the back five. And I'm not quite sure why he did that. I can't work that one out. Because all it meant was we were playing really deep and allowed Spurs to press us deep as well. So we were then looking at trying to lump the ball over the top to Ollie Watkins constantly. And that might work against some teams. And I know he went off injured, which we'll talk about in a second, I'm sure. But Mickey van der Ven,
brilliant.
He was superb, because that recovery pace means that playing a ball over the top is completely nullified. So I'm really confused by what the approach was from Villa this game. Like, I spoke to a few people today and they said, what happened to Villa at the weekend? The honest answer is, I don't really know. It was like they weren't there.
Well, I think Spurs happened to Villa. It's as simple as that. They were set up really well to nullify the approach. The press was intense at times. The whole back four for Spurs were fantastic. You know, the defensive players getting forward, Udogi was brilliant. Pedro Porro has been great. Romero as well, I thought, was really good part. He's been a really good partner, hasn't he, for van der Ven. But Spurs, I think, especially in the second half, kind of almost doubled down on that approach. And it was a difficult one for Villa to answer. And I think that bodes well for a team that are looking at Champions League football in a different way now. Because the last time Spurs were in the Champions League and trying to compete, it was a very different outlook, a very different team, a very different set of players, and very reliant on Harry Kane. But I think this Tottenham team, with a few embellishments potentially in the summer as well, is one that could cause a few teams problems in Europe.
It is, yeah. I think I am still a bit sceptical over them, to be honest. Like, you say, what happened to Villa? Spurs happened to Villa. Let's not forget, Villa beat them 3 times in a row before this. So, like, they definitely had their number. This was just a particularly good performance. And actually, it puts Spurs in the driving seat for top four, because they're 2 points behind Villa now with a game in hand. But Spurs do feel more inconsistent to me. Like, there's been a few times this season where I've worried about Spurs catching Villa or kind of cementing the place over. Then they go and pick up like a random draw. Mm. And you think, oh, okay, that's a game that they really should have won. So this feels like a bit of a marquee result for Spurs right now, and one that Villa really didn't need. And it means that there's massive repercussions for Thursday as well. It means that Villa have to go and really kick on in the Conference League for two reasons. One, because they want the trophy, and two, because they need the coefficient to get a higher placement as well, don't they? So hopefully I'll watch a win on Thursday.
I think there's that. There's the West Ham Freiburg game as well, because I think Germany, the other team competing in the coefficient to kind of
above
them. If West Ham don't win that, then that looks a different like thing altogether. And obviously Arsenal have got an overturned Porto result, haven't they? So there's a few big games that are coming up in Europe that could change the shape of the top four or top five as well, which is fascinating. I'll move on to next is Wolves. They're not going to get relegated anytime soon. And despite our thoughts at the start of the season, go back and check our predictions video. I'll link it if I have to, just to show us up a bit more. But I'm happy to say that we're probably wrong on this occasion. And the way Wolves beat Fulham this weekend, you know, against all the odds with the injuries they've got stacking up and a couple more injuries to boot in this game, the job that Gary O'Neill's doing, we've said it so many times in the last few weeks alone, but this has surprised us on another level again, this result, hasn't it? Because it was so unexpected, even for him. He even said in the post-match, you know, if we qualify for Europe, which is definitely in the kind of equation now, it'd be a huge achievement.
Oh, incredible. And it's funny, like, you are right. We both at the start of the season just thought that the chaos that ensued around Lopetegui moving out so late in the season as well, it's less than ideal circumstances for a manager of any kind of experience level. Yeah. So for O'Neill to come in and take on this squad and make it his own, really, because he's not really done that in the market, has he?
No preseason. That's
purely out of his coaching. Exactly. So I think it's a fantastic achievement for him. And watching him speak, actually, post-game as well, it's quite easy to feel quite optimistic for him.
I think so, yeah.
And appreciate what he's doing. I think it's a really nice thing. And this game, I think, was one of the ones that impressed me the most so far with Wolves, weirdly, because we're talking about a Fulham side who are in red-hot form. I mean, not at Molineux. Apparently, they've not won at Molineux for 40 years or something ridiculous. Like, it's a really long run. And I think they scored right at the end of the game. It was the first time they'd scored there since Andy Johnson scored. Wow. I think. Okay. 13 years ago. So it's a weird fixture for them. But even being said, like, we're talking about a Fulham that looked transformed over the last few weeks, and they were playing excellent football. And that first half alone would have been enough to rock most teams. Fulham were the better side in the first half. They created some really good chances. Wolves lost two players, which you never want to see happen, particularly when you're already threadbare. And when one of them is Pedro Neto, who's arguably Wolves' most important player right now. So the fact that they overcame not just the injuries before game, but changed their system during to cope with the kind of obstacles they faced, and their fullbacks got forward to such an effective rate, shows the excellent coaching that's taking place there.
You mentioned the fullbacks. I've got to kind of shine a spotlight on Ryan Aitnori. He's been fantastic this season. And he looked a bit doubtful last season. I think that he had the quality that we hoped he had, but this season and obviously with the change of his role slightly in this game to be more advanced, he really thrived off it, didn't he? Clear man of the match. And again, got to give credit to O'Neill for sort of seeing an opportunity there to use a player in his skill set in a different way, and it worked.
Yeah, because although his goal came from the set piece, you're right. Throughout the game, he was putting himself into really good attacking positions. Mm. There was a moment right towards the end where Wolves nearly grabbed the third, and he was instrumental in that as well. And that's a really encouraging thing. Like you say, it's a player that maybe looked like they weren't going to quite live up to their potential and their ceiling. So again, we've got to give the coach some credit because he's found a system that does suit him. Do you know the other one that I think doesn't get enough credit? Jose Sarr is an excellent goalkeeper.
Yeah.
Like, I think he's really, really underrated. Yeah, I think he's one of the best keepers in the league. If he was playing at United, I have to say, I think he'd make less errors than Onana does, for example. Like, if he was at a bigger club, I think he'd get a bit more attention. I think he's fantastic, Jose Sarr.
Yeah, I think, well, one of the few players who probably weren't performing to their best in the last couple of seasons before this, and, you know, put them in the conversation for Wolves looking at maybe relegation candidates in the first place because there were so many players that weren't performing. But all it took was a good coach to inspire them. I listened to Gary O'Neill and I feel confident and optimistic, and it's that kind of aura of a manager, isn't it? I bet he's a really good man manager as well, and an astute tactician to go with it. And you look at them now, they're in, what did you say, ninth place in the table now, which is mad. Within the, you know, touching distance of West Ham, it's not kind of unfeasible, really. They could qualify for Europe. And in the quarterfinals of the FA Cup too. It's proving to be a mad season for Wolves fans, isn't it?
They're 2 points off West Ham.
Yeah.
And West Ham are seventh. It's only a game. And we know West Ham are quite inconsistent. Like, it's very feasible that in a week's time, Wolves will win a game and West Ham will lose one. That's nothing to shift. They're 6 points behind United.
Yeah. Well, they've got Coventry in the FA Cup quarterfinal as well. And I know that's not a given, but imagine them in the semi-final of the FA Cup. Mad achievement.
Mate, hats off Gary O'Neill. It's funny because you obviously talked about our predictions at the start of this, and like both of us immediately said, as soon as I think, in fact, we delayed recording our predictions at the time, I remember, because we'd all kind of picked, and then the news dropped that Lopetegui had gone, and we were like, oh, that is Wolves absolutely done for. So when you say, yeah, we were probably wrong about that one, I think it's a bit more than probably now, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. Well, I think it was either them or Everton I had in mind for relegation. It's probably a good place to go to next, actually, is Everton. And obviously, they lost to Manchester United. I haven't prepared you for this, but let's talk about Everton's slide as well. We touched on it last week, but they weren't very coherent in this game. And I know they create a lot of chances on paper statistically, but none of the chances ever feel like they're going to do anything. They don't feel like a clinical, well-versed attacking team. In fact, they seem like a bit of a hit and hope, and that feels like a throwback to the Sean Dyche Burnley days, doesn't it, in some ways? If you read Twitter and what the fans think about where Everton are at the minute, they feel the same. And I've got a lot of positives to say about Sean Dyche. He went through some difficult few months, I think, especially when he first took the job. But is there any progress there now, do you think, from a pretty talented team? There's a few players there that we've said arguably would do better elsewhere. Is he underperforming?
Yeah, we talked about this last week, didn't we? That actually there is some quality in this side, but it's so frustrating watching them, because you say about them kind of hitting and hoping, like, and the stats looking like they had a lot of chances. A more clinical side does score from them, though, if we're honest. Like, I don't think it's all 40-yard pop shots. Like, there are opportunities there where they should have been testing Onana far more than they did. I think they were really, really poor in that final third, and that last decision was just always lacking. And again, where's the coaching? Are you forward players then? What are we doing to kind of get them into a better frame of mind? Where are we looking at their movement? Where are we looking at how they convert those chances? Because Beto all of a sudden overnight hasn't become a terrible footballer. Dominic Calvert-Lewin, okay, has been wildly affected by injuries, but the one thing you'd expect a player not to lose is their clinical nature and their instinct. If you said Calvert-Lewin has lost a couple of yards of pace with the injuries he's had, I'd absolutely understand that. But instinct shouldn't go. But it seems to have left this whole squad. It's really worrying for them, because they can't have games where they go to Old Trafford, have an equal share of possession and are creating chances, but come away with absolutely nothing. You can't afford to do that. Like, this was their chance to get something from it. And the naivety that they showed at the back even is not something you would normally associate with Sean Dyche. But the fact that United could get those two penalties and counter so freely, it just seems so obvious. That was all United were ever going to try and do, and they let them.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. You talk about the naivety, and United had two penalties, which were the most definite penalties. Don't think anybody could argue that they shouldn't have been given. Alejandro Garnacho got himself into some good positions, but the challenges were so clumsy. And I think there's an argument United could have had more than two penalties in the first half alone, because Everton just weren't very composed at the back either. And what is that? Is that nerves? Is that just a lack of confidence? Because there's so many good players there with potential. And there's a lot of very experienced players who should know better as well, who aren't standing up and leading the team either. It's a difficult watch for Everton fans this season. I don't like watching them. They're not a very entertaining or likeable team in any way.
I wonder if their heads are gone. I wonder if everything that's happened off the pitch has affected them to the point where they feel like they're fighting a losing battle. And the annoying thing is, they're not, like, they're still not in the relegation zone, but they are sleepwalking their way into real, real trouble. They should have been able to pull away from this.
Yeah.
They have got better quality than they're showing. And actually, when Forest is, like, their performances dropped and their results dropped, and when Luton kind of looked like they were turning some corners but not really getting wins over the line, and Brentford, like we mentioned earlier, I've been saying for a while, I could see them getting sucked into it. There are teams that Everton can climb above, and they're just... it's frustrating. I'm not an Everton fan at all, but even I find it frustrating when you're watching football that it's just pointless watching Everton play, because you know it's going to result in nothing.
I feel like if they'll get through this season, and if they survive relegation, they will get rid of Sean Dyche. If they get relegated, they've kind of got to stick with him in some ways to get them out of the division. But I do think that if they survive relegation, they've got to go in a different direction, because we're talking about the value of a coach with the right coach, with the right team. Gary O'Neill being case in point, not only for Wolves, but for Bournemouth last season, you know, got a lot out of players that were, you know, should have been performing better, weren't. He came in, steadied the ship, got them performing better. Eddie Howe at Newcastle last season, especially, you know, turned around a team that was struggling, a team of talented players. A different manager in charge of this Everton and these players, I think, could do so much better. They're a mid-table team at the very worst, aren't they?
Maybe, but to be honest, to give him a little bit of credit, I don't think it matters who's in charge of Everton while it's being run in the way that it is.
Fair point.
Because there's just no coherent plan. We've said that before. And actually, the closest thing they've had to a plan is to invest in Sean Dyche-type players. So actually, if you took him out, you're then talking about a squad rebuild, which they can't afford to do. We know there's financial implications on the squad. They're going to have to sell at least one asset in the summer. I imagine it'll be Onana. Yeah, it's bleak. That's the only way I can put it. I just think it's bleak.
Yeah, fair point. But that's all we've got time for in this week's pod, mate. Put you out of your misery. thank you for joining us. If you're watching this on YouTube, thank you. We appreciate it. Hit that subscribe button, keep our growth going, and keep entertaining more like-minded people like you to watch our channel. That's what we want in the end. We want more diverse kind of cross-reference of people across the spectrum of Premier League support, which would be amazing. All of your comments, we appreciate them. They're always good to hear different outtakes, different opinions, different outlooks on the game itself, especially in the Premier League. And it's quite a diverse opinion set of opinions we get generally, isn't it, mate?
I was going to say, I'm not sure I appreciate all of the comments sometimes. Now I'm checking.
Nah, it's all good. Yeah, everyone's welcome. But thank you. Until next week, mate. Take care. See you soon.